Here's the factual question for today. Afghanistan's opium cultivation fell last year. By how much? Stay tuned for the answer to that and more as today we look at Afghanistan's economy. Richard Danziger of the International Organization for Migration says that when poppy farmers in northern Afghanistan have a good crop, it means they don't have to sell their children. But marriage for debt relief is not the only form of slavery reported by IOM in Afghanistan. Women are also exchanged to resolve disputes and kidnapped for forced marriage, prostitution, sexual servitude, and forced domestic service. Women and men are bought and sold for forced labor. In addition to moral and human rights concerns, human trafficking for domestic service and forced labor have the economic effect of keeping wages low. According to a progress report by the American Center for Strategic and International Studies, Afghanistan's economy has grown steadily for 3.5 years, but it remains heavily dependent on aid. International government spending accounts for 90% of Afghanistan's total budget, with the United States leading the way at approximately $15 billion a year. Two-thirds of U.S. assistance supports American troops there. Of the remaining $5 billion per year, $3 billion supports the Afghanistan National Army. CSIS U.S. observes optimistically that urban reconstruction has generated short-term employment opportunities in the larger cities, a circumstance which reaffirms what Mark Harold, an economist at the University of New Hampshire, said in 2003. To the extent that this money represents true foreign direct investment, that is, money from the private sector, it caters exclusively to the urban upper middle classes, that is, to the huge foreign expatriate community, the returned Afghan exiles, and the Karzai bureaucrats. It does little to garner mass support or to deliver political stability. Much of it has gone into airlines. Harold and others have pointed out that foreign investors in non-extractive activities do not develop markets, they follow markets, and they tend to produce complicated products in complicated ways in order to appropriate scarcity rents. In the words of the CSIS U.S. report itself, quote, "For the most part, the influx of internationals and the return of millions of refugees have provided new markets for products such as cellular phones, services such as those provided by hotels and restaurants, and traded consumer goods." When Harold was writing, new markets for traded consumer goods meant mineral water, herbal medicines, and textiles. As Harold points out, given the income distribution, the endemic poverty in Afghanistan, and the high-risk environment, no rational investor will gamble asset exposure in Karzai's Afghanistan. CSIS U.S. admits that the post-conflict boomtown effect has its dangers. Inflated asset prices have raised the cost of living for the poor while encouraging the rich and powerful to seize property, sometimes forcing the poor off their land. CSIS U.S. recommends that, quote, "state regulators, therefore, play an important role to ensure a just allocation of the peace dividend," end quote. This sounds as if CSIS U.S. recommends not only the oft-rejected practice of regulation as a legitimate government function, but also the even more reviled principle of income redistribution, which neoliberalizers and their press glibly claim just doesn't work. In addition, CSIS U.S. reports that inadequate salaries for government workers and Afghan police create incentives for corruption. Commanders, the local term our media replaces with the more colorful warlords, still maintain illicit sources of revenue, and job opportunities are lacking for most Afghans, including ex-combatants. Using more than 1,000 local interviews, CSIS U.S. concludes that, quote, "Crime is the chief security concern of Afghans, not Taliban or Al-Qaeda," end quote. Crime here means mainly theft, murder, and kidnapping. A rise in kidnapping, along with occasional reports of children's bodies found with their organs removed, fuels concern that an active trade in human organs exists between Afghanistan and Pakistan. After military spending, opium dominates Afghanistan's economy, accounting for 60% of its income. Farmers prevented from growing poppies under a British-led eradication program have been forced to hand over their daughters to drug traffickers to settle their debts. These claims come from Nangarhar province, which the British have hailed as their biggest success in the fight against opium. Opium cultivation fell by 96% in Nangarhar this year, part of a 21% fall nationwide. But farmers are now coming forward to say that the forced loss of their poppy crop has left them unable to repay debts to drug traffickers who lent them money to buy the seeds. In desperation, they resort to a traditional Afghan practice in which a family pays off its debt by handing over a daughter to a relative of the creditor. Too few legitimate means of wealth generation are available to most Afghans. Growing poppy provides immediate economic benefit. Power, roads, water, and dependable communications are inadequate, especially in rural areas. This severely hampers agricultural productivity and leaves farmers highly vulnerable to bad weather and other shocks, leading many to turn to growing poppy. But persuading farmers to grow something else may take more than rural electrification, new roads, irrigation, and a cell phone TV network. Take, for example, 68-year-old Mohammed Hanif Isamuddin from Langman province, next to Kabul and Nangarhar provinces. For 1 acre of poppies, he can make 150,000 Afghanis, about $4,000 Canadian dollars. If he sows the same acre with wheat, he makes only 6,000 Afghanis, about 165 Canadian dollars. Isamuddin gave up growing poppies of his own volition when he heard that the government was going to clamp down. Although he has not had to take measures as drastic as some farmers in neighboring Nangarhar, his son has had to leave home and go to Iran to find work. "The government is doing the right thing," he says. "According to our religion, opium is prohibited. But if you have to feed your family, you do what you have to do. If people here cannot earn enough to feed their families, they will start growing opium again," he says. The Senli Council, a Paris-based NGO, has put forward a proposal for the legal cultivation of opium in Afghanistan. The proposal points out that while Afghanistan today provides 87% of the world's illegal opium, legal opium-based medicines such as morphine and codeine are in short supply all over the developing world. Australia, India, and Turkey already grow opium legally for use in medicine under licenses granted by the United Nations. This week, both the UN Office on Drugs and Crime and Afghanistan's counter-narcotics minister rejected the idea. CSIS US believes that, quote, "investment in small-scale infrastructure projects could help connect people and provide the necessary inputs for growth." But when they use the term investment here, they are referring to official development assistance from donor governments, not private foreign direct investment or portfolio investment in local companies. In other words, they really mean aid, not investment at all. In fact, the World Bank admits that perceptions of risk by investors and bankers have been a major obstacle to investment in this sense. 3 years into the rebuilding of Afghanistan, the bank concludes, quote, "modern private investment is still weak, largely informal, and unable to compete in the world marketplace," end quote. In July 2004, the World Bank established the Multilateral Investment Guarantee Agency to encourage foreign investment in Afghanistan by providing political risk insurance with coverage capacity of up to $60 million. But so far, they haven't had any takers. Foreign investment, which is usually seen by the World Bank and other promoters of neoliberal globalization as the engine of economic development, has simply not been a factor in Afghanistan. The Afghan Business Center confirms that foreign direct investment is still very low and domestic investment is held back by lack of access to capital and a lack of management know-how. As a result, local manufacturing capacity is also very low, and the country relies on imports for almost all consumer goods. The lack of alternative livelihoods, even for demobilized soldiers, means they and other enterprising rural Afghans have little option but to pick up the gun again, or get into marketing drugs, or slaves, or human organs. Which is worse, then? The Taliban? Or economic failure induced by doctrinaire economic neoliberalism? I'll leave you with that question. That's it for this Monday. This feature draws on material from the International Organization for Migration, the World Bank, the Center for Security and International Studies, Mark Harold's Archivistan Project, the Afghan Business Center, and the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan. If you would like to suggest a story or comment about anything you hear on Monday Morning World Report, email Earthling, that's EARTHLING, at netidea.com. Put Monday Morning World Report in the subject line to make sure I don't mistake your message for spam. I'm Jim Terrell at Kootenai Co-op Radio. Thanks for listening.